And welcome back, everybody, to another episode of Benched with Bubba, episode 704, coming at you on a Monday afternoon to get you ready for the 2025 baseball season. I have a special guest joining me. I had the pleasure of meeting this individual at First Pitch Arizona. People wonder why I talk about First Pitch a lot. It's because I get to meet people like this. And there's a lot of cool people that come out there for first times and get to introduce their brain to the fantasy world. We're just a bunch of nerds out there, as we talk about, loving one thing called baseball. And so this individual is just a statistical genius in my mind. As I am a caveman, he just unleashes all these, you know, ways of doing things through graphs and plots and all kinds of other cool stuff. He had a great presentation with our buddy on the show, Toby at Bat Flip Crazy, and Rob DiPietro. And you can find him on Twitter at Stevo Swervy. Stephen Goodwin, how are we doing, my friend?
We're doing good. Excited to be here. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, very much looking forward to it. I had a blast chatting with you a little bit that I got to chat with you. It's busy. You know, you're trying to talk to everybody and have a good time. So I'm glad we kind of talked there and got this ball rolling. So I'm looking forward to seeing what we're going to chat about tonight about the OCs or just roster construction. So what are you thinking so far here on these 2024 is this your first year kind of breaking down roster construction more so than previous years?
So I've been around the NFBC since 2019. Kind of got hooked in 2019, so I've been around and I've always obsessed over this stuff, like in the off seasons, looking at rosters, like how do the teams that are successful build, like how do the teams put teams together, and not just like the player analysis part of it, but also like the underlying like pieces that build winning teams. So I've kind of always like been doing this. A year ago though, I kind of like broke into Twitter and I kind of just started posting things, and through that I've met all sorts of people. I was in FPAS, you know. Yep. FPAS is awesome, right? Like, yep. Playing poker with Jeff Erickson, you know, like
yep.
It's sick. Like, I had a blast and meeting you, and I'm looking forward to what's in the future too with me. Yep.
For sure, for sure. So you've been playing since 2019 on the NFBC, which is awesome. You've been breaking things down. So let's get into some of your stuff we're going to talk about here, and we'll go deeper on certain things than others. But when you're looking at kind of the 2024, like, do you primarily play OCs? Let's set it up that way. Is that what you primarily play, or what's your favorite format on the NFBC?
So I definitely started out with OCs. OCs are my favorite, but yeah. I've gotten into mains. Like, where my success, like, I kind of had a down year in 24, but – where my success has been is in the OC, but I also play mains. I did an auction championship this year as well. So nice. I only did one DC as part of the CLQ. So I'm not really a DC player, but I don't mind them.
Yeah, for sure. No, that's the beauty of it. There's so many ways to go about it. The auctions are just amazing if you can do them, but I'm a 12 team OC guy myself. So let's talk about it. What are some of the things you noticed in 2024 when you're looking at roster construction for the OCs?
Yeah, so what I've done for this pod is I went back and I looked at the teams that did well in the OC last year. And I went back and see, and remember, these teams did well by the whole season, well in FAB, well in the draft, and well in just managing their roster throughout the season. But what I did is I specifically looked at the teams that did well. What did they do in the draft? So what were they trying to accomplish in the draft, and what were they setting themselves up for to then have a successful season? So what I did for this podcast is I kind of I went through and I evaluated the OC, and I found who I think did the best in the OC last year. And I'm going to walk through some of those teams, and we kind of show what's going on in their build structure as we go.
I love it.
And I have a few things I could share too. Maybe we'll get to that.
If you want to, yeah, because there's a YouTube, like, people do watch it on YouTube. So if you want to, you have the access to share if you'd like. Knock yourself out. There's a present button at the bottom. You can use that and go ahead and feel free to share stuff if you like. Totally up to you. It'd be a lot of fun. So for those listening to the audio only, you can check us out on YouTube as well and get the goodies with that.
Yeah, so I'm going to share my screen, and we're going to start. Can you see my screen?
Yep, there you go.
Okay, we're going to start with John Paulsma, who won the OC last year. And I actually posted about John Bosma 2 weeks ago on X, but what this, so in order to understand what I did, I basically broke everybody's draft into three different parts. The first part is the composition, and that's what we're looking at right now. The composition of the team is what kind of building blocks created, and right now I'm talking about the offense. What kind of building blocks created the offense? Like, what were they doing? Not just at the top of the draft. Were they taking five category bats? Were they taking a heavy power focus, going with four category power bats? So if you're looking at this diagram that I have here, and again, this is just John Posma, and this is the only one that I have pretty to show for this podcast. But what I was trying to do is find all the avenues where Posma took an offensive piece in the draft. So, for instance, middle in John Posma, one of the things John Posma did is he really attacked middle infield. Okay. From the start of the draft, he wanted to fill second base or shortstop with a five category bat that had speed. He wanted speed coming out of his middle infield. And he also, let me get back to this. John Posma won 7 of 13 OCs last year. He got second, and then he got 3/3, a fourth, and a fifth. So what I was trying to do is see, like, the first thing is the composition of the team. John Posma really attacked the infield. He always took middle infield and often filled both those slots early. He also took he was attacking catcher. He was taking two four category bats. So if we look at this chart right here, you can kind of see the avenue where he's going for each position on his team. Okay. Mm-hmm. So the second thing that he did is that the second thing I looked at is the positional context, which is kind of what I was just talking about. And the third thing I looked at is location. Okay, so I just wanted to get those three out of the way. So for John Posma, he always took two closers before round 10 in every single draft. In the draft that he won the overall, he took two closers before round 10. He always took at least five pitchers in the first 10 rounds. Now, originally when I was doing this, I was trying to group everybody's teams that won together and say, hey, 35% of the teams went hitting heavy. And then I was trying to get to these percentages. But what I realized is there's so many ways to win, and it's impossible to, like, categorize everybody individually like that. So things that he was doing is he was staying extreme. John Paulsman never strayed from the balance scale. Whenever he went three hitters, he backed it up with pitchers right after that. And then he went back to hitting, and then he went back to pitching. From a pitching side, and we're going to get to this, but on the pitching side, a lot of where John Paulsman's success was is he hit. Like a lot of people, like, he was taking the Chris Sales. He was missing. He wasn't taking the Bobby Millers. He was hitting on his early pitching and then backing that up with depth throughout the draft. Okay. So, I don't know how much exact detail, Bobby, you want me to go into. I have, like, little things here or there.
No, it's interesting, like you said, because people will talk a lot about, do you take catchers early? You mentioned you took two catchers relatively early, which is big. You talked about when to take closers. Well, he was taking two closers before round 10 in every single draft. It wasn't just like a rare occasion where this took place. You mentioned the balance of a team. I know a lot of people going into last year said, okay, you get an ace. You can kind of wait if you want. It's kind of a glob of guys. And he didn't care. He went and got his dudes. Like, so it sounds like he played about three starting pitchers and two relievers by round 10, give or take, which is pretty good balance, all things considered. And it gets you three more elite arms for those that are waiting, per se, in a 12. It is very interesting. Did you see any differences in, obviously, if he's still taking those pitchers we talked about, that's not a difference per se, but did you see any other differences with him if he, based on, like, where he was drafting, like towards the top or the back end of a draft, or is it still just like he had his same pockets he was pounding throughout the go round?
So yeah, I think he was just setting things. It looks like he was targeting the back end of the, these are all his drafts. So he had a couple Shohei. He like when again, some of this is KDS, right? You have good KDS years, you have bad KDS years. So again, what I really wanted to get from the early bats, like he was pairing speed with power. A lot of people say, oh, we had Shohei Ohtani. Well, Shohei Ohtani was 50-50. So, like, he was getting a lot of his speed in the core of his team. So he was off the bat trying to build a team that at the center had speed, okay? And then another important thing about Posma is how did he fill the rest? Again, I talked about him taking early catchers. He really was going after Sean Murphy last year. That didn't really work out, but he was attacking early catchers. But in the back end, like I'm going to be talking about this to some other players, but the kinds of players people take in the back end, like a lot of the people we're going to talk about today, they took, you know, the vets that fall, you know, the guys that some of the people we're going to talk about weren't taking the shots on the back end. Some of the people we're talking about today did. So Paulsma he mixed a couple things in. He had a couple round 18 Robert Suarez. So like, I talked about how he always got two closers, but he also hit on some a few like random late closers too.
Okay. Yeah. Then that's an interesting point. Cause you hear a lot of guys when we talk, you know, drafting OCs compared like 12 versus 15s, you'll hear like, oh, on the back end, you can take more chances. You have a 7-man bench. You're going to, you know, churn and burn a lot of them. You know, here's your chance to see if you can hit the lottery ticket per se, as some people might say. When then there's the boring vet card. You mentioned Posma kind of sticks to it. Maybe some of these other guys, like you said, we're going to talk about. Some don't, as you mentioned. But like you got Dave Potts, who's a very, very successful fantasy player. And he's talked about forever that, hey, I love the boring vets. That's his thing. Like he loves boring is beautiful. So what else did you see from Posma that stood out? You said he obviously, like you mentioned, you got to hit on the sales. You got to hit on the rubber. You got to hit on these players. That's tremendously huge. But at the same time, he had a recipe for what he was doing. Like, did you see him have a pattern of, like, a consistent player he was drafting late? Like, I got to get this guy. That was kind of a focus of his, or was there anything else you saw?
I did look at diversification. He was pretty diversified. So okay. I think the big thing, what really struck out to me was he was attacking short, like, back to the middle infield. He wanted shortstop, second base. He was getting a lot of Ellie. He was getting a lot, Bobby. He was getting the guys at the top, and he was filling his shortstop with other really good guys. Like he was trying to fill middle infield and third base a lot. He was targeting third base too. So I think that's one big thing that I took away from his drafts. Again, I just want a disclaimer here, like. There's many ways to win. Just 100%. Because John Paulsma won the overall and did these things doesn't mean that next year it's going to be the same. So that's why I went into a bunch of players and trying to show people that there's different ways to win.
No, and I'm glad you mentioned that because when like Ryan on Bubba and the Bloom, Ryan and I, we did a positional recaps already. And one thing that really, really stood out is a position like shortstop. That's why it's really interesting hearing that Paulsma. Like, and yeah, he won the OC overall, but he's also one of the most successful fantasy players we've had in this NFBC game. And to hear him go heavy on shortstop, we talked about on the show after like the between his like 8th and 10th shortstop off the board last year, according to ADP, there's a drop off, like a dramatic drop off. So if Posma's peppering two shortstops pretty early, he does kind of have an upper hand there. Think about it. He's got two of maybe the top 10. And there's 12 teams, so you need at least 12 shortstops, if not more. So he's starting to like take away some of the advantages other people might have if they wait type thing, if that makes sense. I might be wording this wrong, but to do that's big. We've always talked about third base can be a kind of a cesspool at times. So he's finding that maybe the weakness in the field and attacking it, knowing, yeah, outfield has depth. It might not be elite, but has depth. Where like shortstop and third base depth, it's rough at times. So that's a very interesting way to attack it. All right, so who's the next player we wanted to take a peek at on this one? Because these are fun, especially since you've already kind of hinted they don't all draft alike.
They don't, and the second guy, and it's fun for me too because I'm trying to. A lot of what I've been doing around the NFBC is like it's this game is so fun to me. So like me going through these players, it's so fun. Like our second guy is a really underrated NFBC player. His name is Kyle Brinkman. And Kyle Brinkman this year won 4 of his 15 OCs. He got a second, he got 4 thirds, he got 2 fourths, and he got 4 fifths. He didn't have any team under fifth. He also won 2 supers, which are $2,500 buy-in leagues. And he also won a main event league. And he now has – I didn't mention this about Plasma. I'll go back to Plasma in a bit. But Kyle Brinkman has 22 career OC wins, and he has 4 career main wins. And I have him as a top 15 player in the NFBC. So, I also just want to throw this in, bold prediction. I think Kyle Brinkman gets an overall soon in the NFBC. So, what Kyle Brinkman did across, again, Kyle Brinkman had a very sound theme through all 15 of his drafts. Let's start with catchers. On the catcher front, he did not do what Plasma did. Plasma was attacking catchers. Kyle Brinkman is much more likely to take one guy in the middle and then wait to round 28. So in general, across all his teams, he took his second catcher late. So that's one thing. The second thing, The second thing is closers. He also did not do what Plasma did in the draft. He's someone that he was attacking a guy. He wanted a guy early, but he didn't ever take two guys super early, right? When he went in the fourth round, he waited till the 10th round. Now, when he went in the 8th round, maybe he jumped back up in the 9th round once. He went 10, 11 once. He went round 4, round 25 once. He was really only ever trying to get two. So, again, we're going to get to – when we get to 2025, I'll talk about it. But, he – didn't want to spend the draft capital. And a lot of people, when you go look at the overall teams that rose to the top, you'll see a lot of teams, they attacked one and then they found the guy in Fab, or they hit on like a round 18 Robert Suarez, which really helped them. Back to Kyle Brinkman. His offense, though, is built very much like Plasma. So two really good players are trying to put as much speed into their core. When I say core, I mean their first couple of bets. They want at least Plasma and Kyle Brinkman were trying to put 3 or 4 true 5-category bats on their team. And then what they were trying to do was surround that core with 4-category power guys. So they were trying to build a core of speed, add power guys around it so they didn't have to rely on the Bryce Terangs of the world. Now, again, there's lots of ways to build, but that's the way Kyle Brinkman was building. He did not want anyone that couldn't provide his 9 through 12 hitters, not including the catchers, were never speed guys. They were 3 to 4 category power bats that held their weight in power. Now you're going to lose some of those guys to injury. You're going to pick up guys in fat, but by drafting that way, he's building that core. And that's really the thing I took away from both Plasma and Kyle Brinkman's hitting. From a pitching, and the other thing I was going to say about Kyle Brinkman, he's very old school, right? Kyle Brinkman is just scooped, like, for instance, this year, he's scooping up Semien. Like, I haven't seen any of his drafts, but I bet you he's on Semien. I bet you he's on these guys that shouldn't be going in the 100s that are dropping. He's the textbook definition of taking all the vets all the way through the draft. That's how he's building his offenses. And then from a pitching side, he likes similar to his hitting, he likes proven talent. He wasn't taking the shots on Shane Boz. He wasn't taking shots on even in the back end. Like, he was taking, like, again, they don't all hit, but he was taking guys that had innings from years before that proven that they can have success at the MLB.
Okay. So he's not so much a sale guy. So off of injury, did that matter so much looking at it, if you remember?
He wasn't taking injury shots either. So, again, very safe base. Again, very successful player. Playing it safe. Again, a lot of times, like in the OC, you'll hear, like, you got to take shots, like, down the line. But I think that is important. When you go look at the overall, you see teams that did take shots. But there's also these teams that consistently win that were taking that safer route. So, again, just showing that there's different ways to do it.
Yes, some of the things you mentioned there with Brinkman that really stand out to me, because like I told you before the show, I love like interviewing you that breaks these down and other players that break down the way they build, because it brings things to mind like, hey, I should focus on X, Y, or Z maybe a little more than I do and tweak strategy. And power is one of them I've definitely switched to recently. And to hear you say the way they built five category guys and then four and three category guys, but the one major category is always power. Because when I look back at my rosters every year to kind of see where what went right, what went wrong, a lot of the time I can point to power, which gets me because I'm always focused on, well, if I get the 15 homer, 15 steal guys, I have balance. No, you don't. And that's where it's different, because you need X amount of home runs compared to X amount of steals by the end of the season. And, you know, people say you can find steals, so on and so forth.
The negative effects of the power, that the guys that don't have power, I think it's a little understated how much they hurt. Like when they're in their roster. So you can, again, team, you can have one of them, right? It really hurts when you start putting like two or three of those guys together. Cause then you need, if you don't have the Judge, and Austin Riley combo, like you almost, if you're going to go that route, you need extreme power at the top.
Yep. And you're mentioning a lot of these five category guys. Did you see, you know, you could say with either of these two or just in general, did you see like any of these really successful teams getting like a Yordan or something like that didn't steal? So they did. Okay. That's what I was wondering.
Yeah. So we're going to get to some of those teams, but okay, a lot of times, like even Posma, when I say like one of the reasons I didn't group teams together too much is Posma, like if just because you go three hitters with your first three picks to me, isn't necessarily a hitting heavy build, right? If you go three hitters and then you go four pitchers, to me, that's somewhat of a balanced approach. So sometimes he was pairing the, like he had teams with Shohei and J-Ram, but sometimes he was pairing the Ellie with J-Ram and then coming back and adding Devers to that. So again, that's still two big time five category bats and then a really strong four category bat to go with that. So, and then chipping away with the steals, like he had a lot of Simeon, guys like that, that provide power with speed.
Okay. No, I like that a lot. It's a great way to put it. Cause like, again, I use the example a lot. I want like the 15-15 guy, and maybe I want more like the 20-10 guy, that kind of thing might be the angle to shift to a little bit. Cause that's just that bump, the five homers, they got runs, you got RBIs associated. And you know, what if they have one week where the projection says 20-10, but now they're 21-13. And now like it just adjusts so much in the way we build. So it's a very interesting way to look at it in my brain, at least. And you mentioned the two third basemans, like that one example with Posma. I remember, I'll keep referencing it, I apologize. But when I talked to Guilds after he won the OC, cause I was in that draft with him. Like I was in the league, he won the overall. And I remember clearly when we were drafting, I was like, what's he doing? Cause he already had Big Meat Pete in like round two or three. And then he comes back in like round five or six and takes Goldie, cause he was still sitting there. And, you know, old school line of thinking is, well, you already have a first baseman. What are we doing? Taking a second first baseman so early, best available player that still gets you four to five categories. You keep loading those up. And that's when you mentioned like Posma went third base, essentially back to back. That's something that I think a lot of people have in the back of their mind that they shouldn't do. And there's nothing wrong with that.
I can agree with that more, Bubba. And I think there's something to, I don't have the numbers to back it, but there's something to unique teams, right? I tried to dig into this, right? But in a fantasy league, everybody's taken. Everyone's in every league. But when you think about like DFS, like being unique is really important in DFS. So something I've always thought in the back of my mind is like, how do you get different in a season-long roto league where everyone's taking the same players? One of the ways you can do that is to double up on shortstop at the top, double up on third base at the top. I think that like that's a way from the start to differentiate yourself. And I think I don't have the numbers to back it, but there's something to that.
Yeah, I think you're 100% there. It'd be cool to see how this year ends if someone does something similar in that regard. Maybe you'll do it. Who knows? Who's the next name you wanted to break down here? Because this is fun.
The next guy is Brian Brooks. And Brian Brooks won four of his eight OCs this year. He got second in another, and then he got sixth, seventh, 11th. He did very well in the OC. He now has 12 career OC wins. And surprisingly, he also has 17 career second place OC wins.
Oh, man.
So he's been very successful in the OC. He's probably like he had a really good year not getting the seconds. He had 4 firsts and 1 second. So he's improving there. He's improving there. The first thing I wrote for Brian Brooks is he likes his guys, right? He had a very narrow focus of where he was trying to go across his 8 drafts, and that's his style. And I have no problem with that. Like, especially like when you're playing 8 OCs, like you can build different variations of similar teams. That's the first thing I noticed about him. So, from a catcher standpoint, he was an early guy, right? He was getting a guy in the first 8 rounds, and then he was doubling down and getting a second guy between rounds 11 and 15. From a closing standpoint, he really hit on Ryan Helsley this year. Like, he just wanted Helsley everywhere, and that worked out for him. And but he was someone that he was more closer heavy. Like, a lot of all the guys we've talked about so far, they really like seem to just they want to come out of the draft with 2 guys. Brian Brooks always was coming out of the draft with 3 guys, and sometimes even specking on 4th and 5th guys. And that goes to an in-season thing. Like, Brian Brooks probably likes to put 3 closers in his lineup every week, and he probably likes to. I also wrote for starting pitchers. He's attacking K guys. Again, I think this is something I've missed with a lot of the guys talking about. They are going after the Ks, but it was very evident with Brian Brooks. He again, narrow, especially at the top. He wanted his guys, and then he also attacked infield. He went after the shortstops. He went after the second baseman. And he also is he's a prospect guy, right? None of the guys we've talked about so far have really been like this, but he's taking the shots on the young guys. He's taking the Jackson. Again, Jackson Holly didn't work out, but he hit on the Jackson Churios. So he's willing to take the what I would call high draft capital on some of the guys that creep up. And that's something that I haven't really seen from the guys from the 2 prior to this. They weren't doing that as much.
Okay, so he took more chances. He waited on pitchers, but the closer thing is interesting because I know that's a philosophy I've tried from time to time, especially like in say rounds 25 through 30, specking on a couple guys that might be able to get you there. Because in like the back of your brain, it's well, if they're not going to be the closer, that you can drop them, so on and so forth. Life moves on. If they hit, though, you don't really have to play the closer game on the waiver wire, which is awesome as well because only so many succeed in that regard. So that's interesting. And then again, like a broken record, you mentioned attacking the Ks. That's something else I've so far this year, I've been so, like in the back of my brain, I'm willing to potentially sacrifice a few other minor things to go and lock in dudes. Cause when you look at, you know, 200 strikeout guys last year, wasn't a ton. There's a handful. You can name them. I think it was either 9 or 11 or something along those lines, something small. And, you know, from 190 and above, like the gaps start to stretch out. And if you can get like 2 of those guys, you're already ahead of the game. And that's where I think it's interesting now. It can hurt you in ratios and whatnot. That's a whole other discussion for another day. Can't really predict ratios that well. That's the fun of the game. So it is interesting. Pepper the Ks, he's locking in saves, whereas the other guys, they still were focused on certain things, but a little more balanced with – it felt like more focused on getting those big 5 category, like locking in positions hitting-wise compared to what Brooks did.
Yeah, and he also always put 4 hitters on his bench. So that's different.
Interesting. 7 spots. Gotcha.
A lot of times you'll see 5-2. I see a lot of 6-1 as well. 6-1 being pitchers. I personally think just from looking at all the data, I think a lot of what I see is trying to and build out depth on your bench of starters, right? You want to have somewhere between 10 and 12 starters that you can make decisions with each week. Like, that's something I like to do. And I see that when I see some of these good players, like they're trying to at least coming out of the draft, sometimes they're taking shots, but sometimes they're taking the safer guys and saying, I want to start the season with choices and decisions. And that is something I see as well. But yeah.
Yeah, no, that's always a question, is what do you do with the bench? Like, again, it comes back to, do you take chances or do you want to have those decisions, as you say? Because that's the fun part about this. And to win it overall, you have to be both. But there's a lot of good people, the people that can draft really well. There's a lot of people that can manage in the season very well. There's not a lot that can do both really, really well. That's the big conundrum behind this. So kind of how you draft, I guess, placates hopefully your management strategy on things. So let's go to the next one here. What do you have for Tony Nataro?
Yeah, so for Tony Nataro, he won four. Again, John Paulson won seven, and then a bunch of these guys won four. And I didn't just – there's some – we're going to get some other guys, but Tony Nataro won four of his 11 OCs. He now has seven OC wins. And the other ones, he got second, a third, two fourths, a fifth, a sixth. He did get 112. But, again, very well across the board. And, again, I really – I didn't just – go looking at the volume players, but what the volume players were able to, like, the data is able to show me trends across 15 drafts that of successful players. Like, I did go look at the teams that won, that played one league, one league, played two leagues, one league. Like, yeah, and all the stuff we're talking about is there, but I wanted to see patterns in the successful volume players from this year. And again, it's just the draft. Like you mentioned it prior. You just mentioned it. Like, these teams had to, like, grind through the season to win. They didn't draft a perfect team, right? So I really was – what I was trying to do here is understand just what they were trying to get out of the – what when they got out of the draft, what was at their disposal?
Yep. No, like you said, because a lot of what – I guarantee you, if you talk to at least half these guys, would tell you – that their draft strategy was because, like I said, this is how I can operate in season. I know I can find a closer. If I need to find a closer, I can go find speed, or, you know, these positions are going to be tough, so on and so forth. So that's definitely in line with, I would imagine that's in line with their strategy.
Drafting. Yep. So for Tony Nataro, he is someone that waited, he took a catcher in the middle round, somewhere between round 13 and 17. And then he waited till the end to take his catcher too. I'm someone personally that, like, over the years, like, especially in the OC, like, the value of two catchers, like, it's hard to, like, conceptualize it until it really clicks with you. But, like, people, like, I when I started in the NFBC, I was the person that was like, why am I, no, I'm waiting till the end every time. And over the years, like, I'm now, I was in the second OC. Yeah. I went, I know you don't like Will Smith, but I went Will Smith JTR.
Hey, he's still, real quick, I'll let you finish, but I'll say this for those that are curious. Will Smith, I'm not a fan of being like a top three guy, like some like to claim, or top four guy. Is Will Smith a serviceable catcher that produces better than majority of the catchers in the league? Yes, I will admit that 100%. So it's, I'm not going to speak for you, but if you're talking three to four category catchers, he's 100% one of them. I'm not going to downplay that at all.
Yeah, I think, you know, he had a little bit of a down year, but look at where he is in the lineup on the Dodgers. Like, he's a very valuable catcher, I think. And I'm not necessarily looking, again, when you, it goes back to the speed thing. And one thing I'm changing a little bit, my strategy is about K's this year, and we talked about that, but I've always been speed guys. Like, I want speed at the top. And when you take that, then you can, Will Smith really fits well into that. If you're, like, behind on speed, you start thinking, oh, he doesn't have any speed, but he's a four category bat that is going to help you across the board. I got off track, but so he was waiting for catcher, but he went really hitting heavy. So he wasn't taking catches early, but sometimes he wasn't even getting a second starter until after round 10.
Wow.
And again, he won four of 11 OCs. Like, he again, it's not just the draft. He did well. But, and he is also someone, he was prioritizing power over the speed. Now, because he was so hitting heavy, he basically was doing both. But he was going at the top. Sometimes he didn't get speed at the top, and he went Judge. He would take a Judge Matt Olson or a Judge Riley or and then come back with a Jazz Chisholm. So he was doing it a little bit differently than some of the other guys, but again, super hitting heavy. And he also was willing to take shots. He was taking the Y Langfords, he was taking the Trivios, he was taking the Holidays throughout all parts of the draft. Tony Tora also super K guy, right? He wasn't looking at guys that don't have Ks. Even in the late game, right? He was stashing the Grom. That's not really a good example, but he was going after the Mackenzie Gores. Like, yeah, he was going after the Shane Bosses, like guys that I would call last year's shots. Nothing wrong with them, but he really had no problem taking them. And then closers, he mixed it up with closers, but in general, he took somebody round 5 through 10 in general. Sometimes he didn't, but and then he would wait till round 15, 16, 18. He mixed it up, but he's someone that also buys. Again, it goes back to someone in the OC is going to hit all 10 categories. So because saves are so uncorrelated with the four other pitching categories, like the game theory, again, it all does make sense. The game theory says hit late on closer, right? Pick up the closers, because if you pair that with a team that then just completely hit in the draft on everything else, like that's a team that's going to boom. And teams were doing that, but again, the issue with that strategy is, for me, the issue is I want to hit the ground. I like to use two closers and put seven starters in my lineup pretty much the whole season. So I want two guys from the start. I want to hit the ground running week one with two guys. When you take a shot, sometimes you have to wait till week three or four before you have one and a half guys. Like, I don't know. I like to hit the ground running with two guys. That's a neat thing.
Yeah, no, I'm with you too. And like, kind of, you're talking about relievers, catchers, like closers and catchers. I kind of like see them the same way. Like catchers, I usually have like a top 12 to 15. I want at least two of them. I prefer one of the top ones. And then by the end, I want one of the second ones type thing. Same with closers. I kind of have a bucket, like I'll say, where I want to leave with them. Because like you, I want to know how I have two closers by opening day, barring a spring training injury. These are my dudes, and they should be able to get me hopefully 60-plus saves, and I can figure things out from there in that type of scenario. Because like you said, is in an OC, it's such a wild west where you're picking guys up, you're moving, you're shaking. The player pool is different. You've played in the 15s. Like, you look at a roster when you leave a draft in a 12, you're feeling great. Like, if you don't feel good about your 12-team draft, something went really wrong. Or in a 15, there's question marks sometimes already, and that's just the reality of it. So I get it. Like, I don't want my question marks, I guess, in a 12 to be my closer. Let's put it that way. That's where I don't want it to happen. So I'm 100% with you on that. All right, let's talk about Brandon's. I've seen him in a few of my leagues, and so I'm curious what you got. You got on Brandon here?
Yeah. So Brandon Waddle, I think he goes by Corked Wood on X. He's a really good player. He won 4 of his 14 OCs this year. He got 2 seconds, 4 thirds, a 4th, 2 fifths, and an 8th. Did very well. He has 20 career OC wins. Okay. Again, going just back to it, I just trying to pick successful players here that have consistent winning in the NFBC. Not necessarily just this year. Guys that have proven track records of what are they doing in the draft. Again, it wasn't the only thing I looked at, but I just getting back to that point. I wrote that he's an OC specialist. He kind of just does OCs in the NFBC, but he's really good at them. Hitting, he attacked the infield. Probably sound like a broken record here. This is one of the big themes that I think I think it is talked about, but you know, securing production out of the infield, getting strong stats out of your third base, getting strong stats out of your middle infield. There's nothing wrong with trying to play the shortstop game, but you can really get an advantage stacking the middle infield and third base. First base in general is a position that, when I say infield, I kind of leave out, it's included, but a lot of people, like, again, it's the board is always changing, right? But the way first base has kind of been in the last half decade is there's just guys throughout that some of that can meet the power requirements. And now that's changing, but a lot of times, like, from a first base theme, people were waiting. But that doesn't mean they weren't sometimes adding the Freddie Freeman and like Freddie, for instance, Freddie Freeman. Like, to me, I see five category. A lot of people will be like, "Oh, he's not a five category bat." To me, like,
yeah, he is.
He is, and he's getting an elite other four. Again, he's not an elite speed five category bat, but he is a five category bat.
Yeah.
Again, speed with power, another huge theme, right? These teams, again, like 46 teams in the OC had Shohei that won their league. There were 228 leagues in the OC. Like 48 of them had Shohei Ohtani. But you can get lost in the Shohei Ohtani, or you can understand that Shohei Ohtani was a 50-50 player. Like,
yeah.
This year, getting core that much speed out of a really good player, like, it's a huge benefit. So again, I'm not just pointing out, oh, all these teams that had Shohei and stuff, they were really attacking, whether they wanted Shohei or not, they wanted speed out of that pick. And then the other thing about Brandon Waddle is, and he's another guy, proven vets from a hitting side, like, he wasn't taking shots on guys, he was creating that core. Again, very balanced approach. Putting a bunch of five category bats, surrounding them with a bunch of four category bats, and then adding three category power guys to the back end of that. So, like, his 9 through 12 hitters weren't power deficient. Another big theme. From a closing standpoint, from a catcher standpoint, he's another guy that tended to wait. He took a guy in the middle. He didn't wait for both. He took a guy in the middle, and he waited till the end. So we're kind of seeing different philosophies on catcher, and that works for people. And like, people point to Yainer Diaz popped up out of nowhere a couple years ago.
Yep.
And people who picked him up that year hit huge on that. So, like, yes, like, these a lot. That's where Brandon Waddle wants to do. He wants to find the Yainer Diaz. He's okay adding the Patrick Bailey midseason, you know, adding the guys that, you know, sometimes leagues, especially in 12 teamers, 10 of the guys aren't even looking at catcher. So it is a little easier to fab the catcher, but there has to be the guy too, right? And catchers are volatile.
Yeah, because the problem is, real quick, I'll let you get back to this, because fabbing the catcher can be one of the cheaper fabs out there. At the same time, like you said, the volatility is, a lot of these guys on the waiver wire we think might hit could be completely five-category duds for the week, and it makes things very tricky at times as well. But sorry, back to where you were. I think you're going to go to closers potentially on this next one.
Yeah, so I'm going to go to the pitching side. And this, again, Brandon Waddle. Brandon Waddle did have three I didn't mention this at the beginning. I had a few, like, random stats. There were 9 Strider teams that won their league in the OC out of the 223 leagues. There were only 11 teams that took a pitcher in the first round that won their league. And there were only, like, 42 teams that took one pitcher in the first two rounds that won their league. So, again, there's not as many pitchers. So you can't just say, like, 25%. Like, it's all a balance, but that – in the first round, 11 teams that took pitchers won their league. 9 of them had Strider.
Interesting.
So Brandon Waddle on the pitching side, he took early guys. He mostly always took guys in the top 10 rounds. He sometimes made that the 11th round, but he was targeting early guys, and then he was taking some shots at the back end. So he was adding the third, fourth guy, hoping for guys to hit here or there. From a starting pitcher side, besides the fact that he went 3 Strider, he actually waited on starting pitcher. So even when he took Strider, he then focused on hitting. So again, he's another guy. It goes back to his hitting. He likes vets, right? I don't want to just say vets. Like, I really tried to, like, decouple players from what the analysis I did here, because I think it's important to understand that, like, you have to hit on the player analysis for sure, but you also have to, like, build the right team. So if you know how to build the right team, you can then start to what works well for you. For Brandon Waddle, He wanted guys that had pitched before. He wasn't taking shots on the rookie guys that hadn't pitched before. He wasn't taking, again, he missed, yeah, he missed out on some guys, but that's his strategy. Again, it's just, it's very evident when you go look at his drafts. Like, he just didn't take the shots. And a lot of times you'll hear, like, you have to take shots. I think that, like, from the data I looked at, yes, I think shots are important, especially, like, getting, we'll talk about the overall in a second, but it wasn't always those teams. Some of the most, I'll call them, I don't even think they're boring, but, like, sometimes the vets, you know, they're mispriced. There's a bunch of them 100%. This year that are mispriced. Yeah.
No, 100%, because everyone, well, not everyone, a lot of people like the flashy new toy, and that's the reality of it, and that's what lowers the price tag, especially early in draft season on some of these potential boring veterans. I'm a fan of that. One thing, I know we've said catcher a lot and shortstop, third base, we mentioned, but as a whole, when you've talked about these builds, it's more just like they want these five categories players. There's not really like a focus on, hey, I got to have a first baseman and so on and so forth. You know what I'm trying to say? Like, I'd have two outfielders or three outfielders. They're just building their team, and then they're going to keep building around the statistics that build the team.
Exactly. I think
that's very important.
And you're going to lose some of your core too. I talk about it from like a core sense, but like you're trying to build this core, but of course you're going to, you know, there were, not to just bring random stats, but there were like 16 teams that drafted Acuña number one that won their league. So like, again, the thought process, the process was right for them. And I don't think that just because you were going after Acuña last year and you missed doesn't mean you should be I think if you're a guy that likes speed with power, I think you, again, I'm not saying take Acuña. I'm probably out on Acuña this year, but like, you know, I wouldn't like Acuña. I wouldn't let Acuña scare me from going back to the power speed. Well,
makes sense. Anything else on Brandon Waddle, or would you like to talk about Matthew Duggan?
Okay, so I actually, so for Matthew Duggan, I have something different. And then the last guy I have what we've been doing, but for Matthew Duggan, I actually ended up taking him out of the outline that I sent you, but I will talk about him real quick. He won, and the reason is he played 19 OCs. He won four of them. He did well. He also got four seconds and two thirds. He also won his first main this year. Like, Matthew Duggan had a really good year. I just, when I was organizing all the stuff, I actually took out his exact construction, but I actually added some notes here. I just want to, because I've been talking about OC players, I want to run down this list real quick. It'll take me 1 minute. And these are just players that won leagues in the OC that did really well. Timothy Buth won three out of his seven OC leagues. Trevor Gobble won two out of his four OC leagues. Brendan Gobert won two out of three OC leagues. Elliot Landry won both. He only did two, but he won both. Drew Fort won two out of his four. And Drew Fort's an overall OC winner.
Yeah, 2023 overall OC winner. Yep.
Scott Gilbert won two out of his three OC leagues. Dave Petrizzola. Zolo.
Yep.
He won two out of his three OC leagues. So just because I was going through all the data, I just wanted to, and I'm saying, I didn't want to like make people feel like I didn't look at them. I really went after the volume guys because I could see trends in their data.
100%.
You just have two drafts. Not that I can't see trends between two drafts, but I'm not really sure where your head, if I see 13 drafts and,
yep,
and 12 of them, you did really similar things. Like, it just made for better like notes for what.
It's like, hey, in any research that you do, that's why you do multiple plots. That's just how it works. So you have, the more reps you have, the more analysis and data you can take from it. 100%.
And then the last guy I really dug into, who is Nikolai Knutsen.
Yep.
Who won four out of his eight OC leagues this year. He got 2 seconds and two fourths. Didn't have a team under fourth. He did extremely well. He also won his first main this year, and he qualified for the Champions League.
Yep.
And that's kind of like, for me, like, I was helping covering the Champions League stuff over the season, and I have so much fun doing that, and it's really exciting. I'm definitely doing the Champions League qualifiers again this year. I didn't do well, but again, I had a down year. We can maybe get to that at the end, but I really missed on pitching this year. So so back to Nikolaj Knudsen. He's also he has 11 career OC wins, and he really didn't start till 2021.
Yep.
So he's been piling up the wins in the last couple of years. His hitting, again, kind of trying to keep it understandable for everyone. He had a very power early focus. He was someone that different from everyone we talked about so far. He was targeting the power way more than the speed. He's a prospect guy. He was very much in on the Churios, and you know, there's certain people in the NFBC that like. It's not me, so I don't quite understand it. But again, a lot of success. Nikolai's. I've met Nikolaj. Like, he's a really good dude. Like, so I'm not like throwing any shade or anything, but he definitely likes his prospects, and he's willing to take them at the prices they go. And then the other thing about him is he's a little bit opposite of everyone we talked about from like a construction standpoint. Everyone we talked about so far was really like scattering outfield throughout the draft. Like no one we've talked about so far was going like three outfielders in the first four rounds. Now, Nikolaj Knudsen was willing to do that. He was actually trying to get at least two guys really early. And he also was attacking that third base. So he was trying to put elite power in his third base with the elite. He had a lot of Judge, like going with the Judge. Again, he had some speed guys too, but a lot of times you would see I don't know, Judge, Matt Olson, Riley, or something like extreme power focus at the top. And then from a pitching standpoint, closers, again, attacking early, taking a guy fourth, fifth, sixth round, doubling back down seven through eight. And one of the Trent, I'll finish with his starters first. His starters also, he had a mix. He wasn't, it just like his hitting, he took a lot of like the guys at the top that were vets, guys proven track record. But this is something that maybe I'm learning to adapt to too, but he was taking the Jared Joneses of the world last year. And I think, again, smart shots here or there, he was hitting. Again, really successful player. He was hitting on those players. So I could go more deep, but that's kind of in general. Like what I was really trying to find was like just common things, like the middle infield thing, just trying to understand and I have this site that I've been working on where you can see like the categorical shapes of teams and trying to see like, coming out of the draft, what did after the first quarter of the season, what did the shape of their team be? And maybe we'll get to this, but trying to understand, you know, if you only take two closers, you give yourself the ability to pick up the third guy, right? If you hit on three or four closers out of the draft, you're obligated to put them in your lineup, and maybe you start putting in less starts, you lose wins because of that, you lose case. So giving yourself the opportunity to, you know, maybe you took two early ones, but then you didn't take any other ones. I think, you know, the value of adding that guy later in the season, I think is really important.
Interesting. I definitely see where that's coming from, because it's even like, not even just the closers makes total sense, because it feels like if you have three to four good closers, well, you're going to put them in your lineup each week instead of sitting them and playing roulette with them, basically. Same thing go with like certain hitters. Like, I have these elite hitters. How do I sit them type situation, even though I have a guy picked up on the wire who's maybe the best second half player we're going to see all season, so on and so forth. Like, who do you play and sit type scenarios, which becomes very, very interesting. But that was fun because, yeah, Nikolai, I know him as well. He's been on the show. He's good dude. Good dude. Very fun player. So, look forward. I actually will meet him in Vegas this year, so that'll be a lot of fun as well. Let's talk about kind of maybe an overall kind of viewpoint here, because that's one thing that I've always struggled with. Like, I'm just trying to win my league, and then I talk to these really successful players, like, hey, how do you draft for the overall per se? And I know there's in-season stuff and everything, but when you're looking at some of these teams that finished well in the overall, what kind of similarities and differences did you see in these players, these teams?
Okay, so this is where I want to express some caution, because if you go looking at the data, and I implore everyone to like go look for yourself, like go look at what teams did, because I'm seeing through my eyes. But if you want to find, like, you will find the team that, like, what you think, like, you got to be really careful, right? So it's kind of a loaded question what you just asked, right? Mm-hmm. You start go looking at the overall, like, you can get lost saying, oh my gosh, these three teams did this, these two teams did this. And you got to remember, this is last year. Things change every single year. So I think the number one thing, the first thing I wanted to say is balance. I think there's this idea that, like, teams at the top maybe, like, take some extreme strategy and, like, that's what's elevating them up to the top. I don't think that's the case. I think the teams that took a balance, again, just because you take four hitters in a row at the start of the draft doesn't mean you're hitting every build if you go a bunch of starters after that. So keeping the balance of your team together, right? You need all 10 categories. You need your team to be working together, right? If you got all the power guys and then you add in the Maciel Garcia or you add in the Bryce Terang to help catch you up in speed, you need the right guys to fit everything together. So the first thing I want to say about the overall is, like, if you go start looking at the overall, you will find the bias isn't everyone. You'll find the teams that you think, oh, they did that, that's what I should do. Oh, these people did that. I don't think there's one thing that brings the overall. You'll see teams that took shots, right? You'll see the teams that had Paul Skeens. And you'll say, oh, I have to go get Bubba Chandler this year. Again, I'm not saying don't take Bubba Chandler. I'm just saying, like, that's what
happens. Not a must. Yeah.
So that I just want to express caution. And I actually really do implore, like, I've built some tools to help me look at this data a little bit easier, so I don't have to, like, poke around the NFBC site too much. But, like, I think you'll see teams that are perfect. You'll see teams. John Posma won the overall. He took two closers, rounds six, and I think that team was 6 and 9. Mm-hmm. Super balanced. Again, the team was a Shohei JRM team, so you can point to that, or you can point to the fact that throughout the entire draft, again, it wasn't just the draft that won the league. His management won the league too. Yes. But you can point to the top two guys, or you can point to how he built a really strong foundation of power, speed. Right. Again, when you do that at the top two, you're kind of inherently getting average too. I know there's this big focus this year on, I want average, I need average. But, like, you can't get too far away from the fact that you need these teams. A lot of the teams at the top have a dominating, especially in the AOC, a dominating hitting core. Absolutely dominating. Sometimes 3, 4, 5 elite five category bats. And then pairing them with the Santanders of the world. Mm-hmm. Pairing them with the guys that are going in the 100s, 200s that aren't the speed guys. They're dropping. This year it's Adolis Garcia.
Yep.
This year it's Castellanos. Like, these guys that, just because they had a tiny down year last year, they're getting penalized even though they shouldn't be. I think that, like, that's, again, I'm not just pointing to Posma, but that's how Posma builds, right? He takes the discounts on the guys that shouldn't have fallen, and he takes the vets that have, especially bats, that just, guys that are, again, the other thing is, like, these guys are hitting first, second, third, fourth in the lineup, and they're going around 200s up. I think there is something to the lineup position thing too. So that's one thing. The second thing is, you will see people taking the shots, right? You'll see teams that did everything I just talked about, but also had Paul Skeens. They did everything I talked about, but they got around 18 before earlier season. I'm going to get to, I didn't put it in the outline, but I'm going to get the timeline of OCs too. And one of the reasons I want to do this pod with you is OCs are starting up. And yep. I think there's some really, really interesting things about the early OCs. But, you know, like, people were taking, they're hitting on the shots, but the back end of their drafts weren't just like, 10 guys like that were mixed with guys that also added to those cores. And I didn't really talk about the pitching core because pitching's a little bit like there's not as many positions, so it's a little hard on like see the core, but building that ratio base and building that K base and then adding onto it, and then you add the guys you want to take shots on. I think that's something I was seeing. So again, I tried to like what the other day I was trying to like bucket every single team. And I was trying to like be able to come on this pod and say 15% of the people in the top 50 did this. And I was going through all the data and I kind of stopped myself because you can find anything you're looking for if you're looking for something. And I didn't want to think that way. I wanted to take the players out of it and understand what are the teams being built. And maybe not everyone thinks that way. You know, some people it's all players, but I think you need to have a plan. You need to understand you need to have a plan for every position, not just second base. You need a plan to go through. You need to know what you can get at the end of the draft in order to decide what you're going to take at the top of the draft. I think the teams that are successful are thinking about that. And they're saying, hey, they're finding the pockets. And they're, because of that, they're attacking where they feel that they need to get those certain positions.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. It's something I've tried to talk about a lot in the recent years, at least for myself, and hopefully it goes off to others, is like, I love the idea of just show me stats and block out names. Just do that because so I can build my team based on the stats I need, fill the positions up. I don't care what the names are. Guys talk about building backwards to the front of the draft, which makes sense because, like you said, you know what you can get late, helps you know what to take early type scenarios. There's lots of ways to build a draft, obviously, but and I know a lot of smart people that'll sit there and pencil out their round by round, like here's three guys, like the buckets that they can go through to make picks and everything to try to help them get to where they need to get to as well. So lots of fun strategies involved in that. What else did you see when you're coming out of the drafts? Like, are there any trends that you see some of the successful teams? Like, you know, we've already talked, you know, power is very important. They want five categories, but powers seems to be kind of the leader of the clubhouse offensively. Strikeouts were a leader in the clubhouse for pitching. What are some things you noticed categorically when you looked at these teams?
Yeah, so one of the things I was doing with the CLQ last year is, you know, I talked about earlier, like looking at the shape of teams. So, like, I wanted to see if, you know, teams that went hitting heavy, like what I consider hitting heavy, did they come into the first quarter of the season hitting the ground running? Like, and, you know, again, lots of data, lots of different things. The data is noisy. The data is very noisy. But, you know, in general, I really do see, like, from a hitting side, I've talked about this before on other pods, but the hitting categories are really correlated. Runs, home runs, RBI, and average are the core four hitting categories, and speed comes with that. So I wanted to see that, like, teams that focused on that core, like, where were they necessarily lacking, where they weren't. And again, the data's noisy. I don't want to just end it there. Like, you could go find teams that look different, but like John Posma, for instance, he did extremely well. His teams were coming out of the draft with that hitting core, right? His teams were coming sometimes, like, maybe the pitching core, like K's and wins were lacking, but like sometimes there's a lot of decision making you can make on the pitching side to change things. There's this old adage, like, take good players. And you know, I don't want to say it, like, that's their, I wanted to see, like, the offense that these players are building, like, is it translating to the stats their teams are building in the beginning of the season? And for the most part, like, from a hitting side, it was yes. From the pitching side, it was, did you hit on pitching or not? Like, I think pitching analysis and like the guys, the subset of players that you're drafting, right? I'm someone that brings down the player pool. I'm not looking at certain players. Like, I think hitting on the right guys, like learning how to do that, I think that's a really important thing in the NFBC. Yep,
100%. when you're looking kind of at an overall OC look, I know you said you got some, like, you know, draft seasons, I guess, or if you're ready to go that direction. Not sure if you're ready to go there yet.
Yeah.
Like, because that's one thing is I like to do, like, early season. I'm like, I do my DCs and my NFBC 50s. And then I usually wait on my OCs. I'll do, like, one in February and then do the rest in March closer to the season. But obviously, this year, the first year, they're doing slow drafts. We'll get to that in a minute, since you took place in one of those. But what have you kind of noticed based on timing of doing these drafts that maybe has a difference?
So this year's really different. The OCs are earlier than ever this year, and a couple people have already even done their, like, Champions League qualifier teams.
Crazy
and stuff. It is interesting because I think the biggest thing that, like, has been going through my mind, and it's the reason I wanted to get in an early one, is the first week waiver wire. Again, we just talked about how I like to take early closers, but in this draft specifically, I got one guy, and that's basically because come the first week wire on these teams, there's going to be 2, 3, 4 guys that have the role on the wire. It's going to be a Fab Fest week one. And I think this is a really, like, underrated topic. Like teams like Phil Dassault did his CLQ team. And I think part of the reasoning to doing it this early is banking, hey, I don't need to attack closers in this draft because I'm expecting 3 or 4 guys to be on the wire. Guys that we don't even know that are going to pop out of nowhere because of injuries and stuff. This happens every year. So, again, this happens every year, even when there's not early, slow OC drafts. Even the last year they actually started in December, right around Christmas time, and, like, it was similar. Like the wires on these early OCs are crazy. So, again, you got to hit. You also got to buy the guy, right? If there's 4 closers out there, you know, it's gonna be wild. But if you draft your OC in March, all those guys that are going to be on the wire for the teams that are drafting now are going to be, like, 10th round picks. They're going to be, like, closers that got the job that skyrocketed up the board. It's not just closers, right? It's all these other, like, the guys that are going to, all the rookies that are going to move up near 100. If you want them now, if you wanted Wyatt Langford last year in the OCs, you could have been taken around 160, 180, and then all of a sudden he moves up into the top 50. You know, like, that's the benefit of the early OCs. Now, you're talking to someone that does a lot of, like, last year I did a lot of early OCs. Like, it bit me in the butt last year. Last year I had multiple early shares of Kyle Bradish. I had Bobby Miller everywhere. I was picking up all the Chris Bassett in the middle of the 100s. Like, I really just, like, screwed up pitching really bad last year. So I think, like, from an early OC look, I think there's so much value in the builds you can create. I think anyone that plays vault, let's just say you play 5 OC leagues, I think you should get into these early ones because, like, the kind of builds you can create now are different than the kind of builds that are going to be created in March. So I think that's, like, the big thing from the data standpoint. I didn't timeline everything out. Like I know for a fact, John Paulsma drafts were middle of February through March. So Paulsma wasn't playing the early draft game, but you know, like Steven Weimer in the DC,
yeah,
in the DC, and that was, like, in October DC. Yep. Now, I think there's definitely something to the DC about that, but now with these early OCs, like, I hate slow drafts. I actually don't do that. I don't do a lot of DC, so they drive me crazy. Like, people, I have a plan. I just can't. My mind is always thinking about it, and especially when it's, like, 2 picks away, and both people, like,
take the full.
Oh, time. Man, like, I lose my mind.
Yep, I get it. And I'll do the slow DCs, but when it comes to OCs or other drafts, like, we're blowing and going. I'm not doing that. I'm sitting here ready to go for a 2.5-hour draft, and we're gonna bang it out. That's where I'm at on those ones. Yeah. So I feel you there. What else from 2024 do you have that stood out to you, I guess I should say, before we talk a little 2025 action? But anything else stand out to you in 2024 when it comes to the OCs?
So I think I kind of went through, like, everything I wanted to for 2024. Yeah. I think that, like, again, I just want to stress, we'll get to this with 2025, but every year is different. I don't think, like, that what I'm looking, I'm not, everything I've talked about today, I don't think you should say, take it face value and say, I'm going to do what people did in 2024. But I think what I'm trying to do is open up the thought process. What is your strategy? How can this stuff maybe not, don't totally change your strategy because somebody else won four leagues. Like, you know, incorporate what makes sense to you, but there are things to learn. Like I think the middle infield thing, that's something that, I don't know. I see it in the data. I think it's real. But other things like me pitching, I failed on pitching, but I am going a little bit more K focused this year, but I'm not turning around and taking four starters to start the draft off. Like, I realized that in order to build a good OC team, I need the hitting, but also need to add the right pitcher. So, I think I kind of went through what I wanted to with 2024, and maybe we can get into 2025.
For sure. Let's talk 2025. Few drafts have been going, of course. You took part in one of the slow OCs, like you mentioned. What are you seeing when you from the early 2025 data that we're looking at?
You know, I'm seeing a lot of value in the draft. Like, again, I'm a veteran. Especially with hitting. I'm a guy, like, why is Marcus Semien going so low? And like, Dude's perennial third rounder the last couple of years. All of a sudden, he's going in the, again, we're talking OCs, but all of a sudden, he's going in the seventh, eighth round, scooping that up everywhere. Like, again, it's just how I build. Like, I see, for me, like, things are mispriced. Like especially hitting. Like, maybe it's just me, but, like, the guys I'm targeting hitting-wise just seem like, the guys that are falling, like yep. I talked about Adolis Garcia. Yep. I don't even really like Adolis Garcia that much. Like, I wasn't last couple of years, I haven't been taking him because he was going in the fourth, fifth round with a bad batting average. Not bad, but, like, not great. But now all of a sudden he's going, I got him in this OC, like, near pick 150. He had a down year in power, but he's sitting in a good lineup that, He's gonna have the runs. He's gonna have the RBIs. He has power. He's the perfect guy to add. He also has a little speed. He's the perfect guy to add to a core that was built from the start, speed and power. So, I think that's, like, I think there's, I don't need to get into everyone, but I think hitting, there's a lot of mispriced hitters. That's from my analysis what I'm seeing from a pitching side. It also, again, it goes back to the early drafts right now. A lot of these pitchers are going to move up. Guys, like this isn't some Baltimore homer thing. Like, Zach Eflin's going, like, super low. Like, he's going to be the number – whoever – I do think the O's signed someone. He's going to be the number three, like, behind Grayson. So, like, I don't know. I see – I'm seeing, like, got – I think there's a lot of value to be had, pitchers that are going to rise a lot. Like, you know, there's a lot of different things you could point to, but yeah. I think the early builds that are being created are going to change drastically over the next couple of months.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. That's why, like, for us to do the DCs early, it's A, to get a feel for the player pool, but you also see a ton of those, I guess, quote unquote values when we're drafting that, you know, is going to move up. But yeah, for, like, the fab leagues, like you mentioned, the pitching is going to start climbing up and it's going to change things a ton. And it just takes one or two injuries or something to really change the landscape of certain ADP departments. And makes things really, really fun in that regard. What else you got from 2025 that you're looking at here? Cause we've only had a couple drafts, like I said, but I guess, you know, we've talked about from 2024, what we can learn from that, take away, adjusting to 2025. What else are you seeing for that?
Okay, so for me, so I guess I'll talk about a little bit what I'm focusing on. Like, in my draft, I had the eighth pick. I took Ellie filled eight, and
that's pretty good.
I went Ellie Lindor. So I went shortstop. Again, I'm not afraid of like doing something like that because I do buy into like getting different. I buy it. And again, we don't play DFS. That's not what this game is. But in DFS, it's almost more important to be different
big time
than to try to build the right lineup. So, again, our game isn't DFS, so you can't think that way. But there is a little bit of like
game
one, Ellie isn't going to fall to eight very much at all. Two, Lindor isn't going to get back to the teams that took Ellie. So by getting an Ellie Lindor, I'm kind of getting a unique start. So then I followed it up with Chris Sale and Blake Snell. So again, this is something new, a little changed from what I would have previous. I would have always probably taken a third hitter. I wanted to make sure I get a ratio K base. Like for me, like, again, it goes back to my season last year and how I like to build and where I've had success and where not. For me, I wouldn't have always gone back to back starters there. This year I did. It's a little different from my builds. But like, I think like K guys in general, like that's something I'm looking at. Like, and you know, on Rob DiPietro's podcast the other day, Greg Martin was on there and he talked about Logan Webb and he said something that really clicked with me. And it was about how like Logan Webb, not only did he not help, again, he had, not only did he not help you in ratios, but every time he was out there, he was hurting you in K's. You're putting a guy out there that not only wasn't helping you in ratios, but also was setting you back in K's week after week. Now, Logan Webb could come back and have a 1.13 whip and 3.5 ERA and be fine. But like previously in my NFBC career, you know, Logan Webb is someone that like feels safe to me, that feels like he's a good foundational piece. I think like that's where my mindset's changing, right? Like I wasn't on Chris Sale last year either. You know, I'm someone that I like to see, I have a hard time trusting, like, especially like where Chris Sale was going last year, like sixth, seventh round, like some people like were all over that. Like I had trouble getting there. So, you know, I'm trying to change that. I'm trying to, you know, change the way my mind thinks so that I'm on those guys this year. And, you know, that's kind of where my head's at from like a drafting point. That's not just 12 teamers. Like that's 15 teamers too. But for me, that's definitely where like, and I've had success in the NFBC too, but that's where I think the most improvement from me can be made on the pitching side. Because last year I did very well building the offenses. I was in a ratio hell last year and I couldn't get out of it.
I understand you completely on a couple of my OCs. Like I was the ones I did good on a couple, I even won one, but the one I struggled tremendously on, you can point to one thing, and that was pitching, as you mentioned. And a couple points you made there, I've talked about it recently, is, and I'm a Giants fan, so I get it. Like Webb to me is a really good real life pitcher. Like he goes out there, he gives the team 6+ innings every time out, does what the team asks for. But fantasy wise, he's basically Jose Barrios going 50 to 70 picks earlier. Like that's just the grand scheme of things. So he's not helping you where you're taking him. He should be more of an SP3-4, probably like four to for a fantasy team, but you draft him as a two, essentially. That's not gonna help you, like you're saying. The other thing is to your sale point, I had draft cheat on last year, Pete Christensen, and he is a big time DFS player, plays a ton of NFBC. And he really opened my eyes to the concept because I've done it in DFS for years as well. And the game theory part of it is interesting. Like, so Sale, for instance, or some of these kind of pitchers that you might have question marks, is take the innings now. If they get hurt, whatever, but they're going to be elite innings per se. That's what you're shooting for when you're drafting them. You're not going in going, okay, I'm going to get 50% elite. You're expecting elite innings. Take for whatever you can get and then replace them if they get hurt. That's all you can do. Now, Sale ran the whole year, and look how glorious that was. Most of them don't, but you get my point here is maybe not be as timid like you're saying. I'm trying to change my thought process of don't just avoid to avoid. Like there's points where it's okay to avoid. Yes. There's also points where maybe take a step back and realize this is an elite arm.
Yeah.
Maybe take the 75 to 100 innings of eliteness and figure out the rest later.
Yep.
So That's kind of an angle I've started. So that's what I'm saying. Similar to you, I've taken a lot of time to reflect this past year on things as well. And that kind of like, I mentioned some hitting things earlier about don't worry about positions, worry about stats, stuff along those lines, focus more on power. Pitching, I'm with you. It's like some of these elite guys, just take what you can get. Innings pitched is a lot wilder than it's been in recent years. So just take what you can get, kind of. So that's my two cents on that. Anything else on 2025? Otherwise, I got or anything else you got? I'll floor it there. Anything else you have before I hit listener questions for you?
I think I covered what I wanted to. You know, it's all a puzzle, right? The game board is different. I like to think of Roto. This is a silly analogy, but I like to think of it as like Catan, right?
Yep.
Like the resources are in different positions, but the strategy is the same. Right, you still need brick, and you still need wood, you still need steel to build your city. So, like, the fundamentals are there, but again, the prices and the board and the players are different. So, I'll leave it as that. Like, I know that's probably a dumb analogy, but I like the game Catan. So, I played it the other day, so I've been thinking about it.
No, it's all good, man. Like everyone, like, and even in the analogies for the game could be like some people say 40 chess Catan. There's a million ways to do it, which is fun for sure. A couple of listener questions for you. We got one in the chat I want to hit up. Adam Brunchen says, I also like banking some boring hitter stats early, quote unquote boring. I find that those middling like 60, 15, 45, 5, 2, 60 guys find my bench. For example, I have a lot of Mason Wynn bench, second half for XYZ, middle infielder, the fab guy, heater guy. I don't know if that's a winning strategy, but it's a comfort way to build. Maybe I'll find out if there's a wrong approach. So kind of what he's saying is it goes back to when we were talking earlier about building the bench. Like some guys only have four, some guys have five or six, and taking those guys that you're saying you have to make a decision per se. So you take that Mason Wynn late, maybe hold on to him for when it does come through or makes a drop or whatever. But he wanted to give that example as well. We do have a couple Twitter X questions for you. I'm gonna start with one that I have a feeling you know.
Yeah,
the DPH one. Yeah, I got that. I'm like, what's the inside joke here? The best 0.25ers, best quarters, I guess, for 2025 are. What's he even talking about
here? Yeah, so Rob's pulling my strings, but you know, it's a fundamental thing with me, right? I love Rob, I love Greg, I love all of them. They're giving me a hard time about this, but I don't like 0.25. Again, I'll explain myself a little bit. I'm someone that, again, I want to hit the ground running with two closers. So because of that, I attack the draft, take the closer. I want to hit the ground running, getting 3.5+ saves a week. Again, so my roster is my roster is always like five starters, two hitters, sometimes six starters. Sometimes I'm specking on a third guy, but because I want two good guys, I'm not. There's this joke that we have that like I don't like point. There's such thing as 0.5 closers. Does that make sense? Like a guy that has half the job.
Yeah,
I got you. A 0.25 guy is a guy that like.
That's a disaster. Yes,
he's getting a save. Like, he's getting a save here or there. But, like, some people are, like, specking on these guys, like, thinking, like Jason Adams, a perfect example of this. He always asked me for this year. Like, you know, like, this year it's still unsettled who the 0.25 guys are. But, like, you got to think about your roster and how you're building. If you're building and you didn't spend up on closers and you're using two of your bench spots to take shots on – coming up again, there's nothing wrong with like stacking a week early saying I want to save some money and get this guy earlier, but like I don't normally do that kind of thing. Like that's not really my strategy. Like I do again around the all-star break, around certain things, like I'll add that spec, but some people are constantly like changing one spec to another all season long, and they're a lot of times those guys are 0.25 guys. So it's just an inside joke. They give me a hard time about it, but I don't like 0.25 guys.
I don't know. I get it. Now, when you break it down that way, I understand what you're saying. No, but yeah, when he sent that, I'm like, this has to be an inside joke that I have no idea. it's either meatball lingo or something.
But yeah, we were in FBAS actually. Like, we got like it was like late night one of the nights, and we all stayed at an Airbnb together. Yeah. So Like, we just got into it about the 0.25ers.
That's funny. That's good stuff. Tomorrow's Baseball Today asks, how many waiver wire moves per week? And if you don't have these answers, that's fine.
I do. I actually show something for this.
Okay, so he says, how many waiver wire moves per week did the top teams make? How many roster spots were the top teams streaming on average? On average, how many saves, stolen bases did the top team get from their draft first fab? So if you got some info here, I will share your screen, and we could have some fun with that.
Okay, so and I also didn't talk about this. I'm building this really cool thing. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to go to this. I have, like, different ways to view the data.
Oh, sweet.
So, again, what we're looking at here, I'm about to answer the question, but what we're looking at here is, like, this is John Paul's. This is the team that won the overall. These are, again, I did this little demo at FPAS too, but these are all 10 of the category percentiles. Each little line is 10%. So 10, 20, 30, 40, 50. So you can see that this team is very good. Like, it's almost over 90% on every category except for home runs. Does that make sense?
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, I get. Even my brain gets this. This is, see, so, I when I see things, this works good for me.
Yeah, so the cool thing about these charts is a really cool way to visualize your team. There's nothing like this. And I think in season, there's a lot of cool things you can get. I also like tracking at bat data. You know, the 80th percent of at bats is 280 at bats per week. That's 20 at bats per roster spot. If you're not hitting close to 275, 280 at bats per week, you're falling behind the NFBC. That's just a fundamental fact. If you look at the teams that are good, and again, the at bat data is so useful. I'm working on some stuff that can tell me what leagues were good, what leagues were bad. And a lot of it centers around the at bat data. When you have a league where you see the at bat data fall off on six players, like I can clearly see who's giving up on a season by the drop in at bats because they're not managing their team. Also, innings pitch, you can see that kind of thing. So, again, I'm just kind of like showing you
some things. I like it. This is really, really, really cool stuff.
But I also have like total fab moves. Like, to answer his question, I don't have all of his question, but Paul's made 70 fab moves. Again, there's 27 fab periods. You're looking at like 2.5 fab moves per week. Again, it's not all like symmetrical. You know, some weeks there was probably zero ads. You know, some weeks there were five ads. Like, but you'll see normally, like, team two had 64 total fab moves. Team three had 77. You know, they all kind of live in the 50 to 80 range. But then you go look at, like, I'm going to actually change the view. I'm just going to get, like, there's players like, I'm gonna go to Phil Deso because he's someone that like he makes. I'm gonna go to the main too.
Okay.
He's someone that oh, you know what? I don't have it on the screen. I'll just tell you, he's someone that like makes way more than the average. He's doing 90 plus moves on every team. You'll see weeks where he makes seven swaps. And I was tracking the CLQ last year, and his OC where he needed hitting, he was making insane amount of moves, like all sorts of $1-$2 players. But again, the general range that people live in, I'll go back to the OC that we were just looking at. The general range is around 70, right? I don't have the average exactly, but most teams are hitting somewhere between 50 and 80 moves a season. You'll see teams that make 37. You'll see teams that make 55. But, you know, your trends too. You can say that, like, it all depends on your team too. But some people are way more turn and burn, you know?
Yep. And so if they're making about 2.5 moves a week, they're probably streaming them three spots or so, give or take, on the average, you're guessing.
Yeah, so it's a tough question because, like, you – again, just from the data we're looking – again, that I can speak on right now, it's not as simple, I think, as, like, every guy picks – I don't think he's necessarily, like – you got to think he's adding to his he's supplementing his bench. He's also bringing guys into his lineup. So you don't know if every single guy is just, like, meant to replace someone else. But, you know, like – the teams that are doing, you can really see it when you see the teams that do like 100 moves. Like some of them have three spots and they're active hitting lineup, like their outfield four, outfield five, and corner infield that, you know, the hit for 3 weeks and then they're gone.
It's true.
So it's, everyone has their own style, right? And there's so many ways that work. Back to like building teams, like there's no one way to build, right? There are people that have had success doing certain things. There's people that have do the same, like I've had success doing things that I do, right? And then I've had failures doing things that I do. So, you know, you gotta think big picture. You can't just look at 2024 and say, these things didn't work in 2024. So I'm not going to do them in 2025. You have to think, you have to understand why. And I think everyone has different, you know, for me, it was the K's, it was the ratio stuff. For everyone else, it was something that was unique to them. So you need to think about those things and make adjust. Again, I would stress against making too drastic decisions, but it is helpful to go. I think this data is incredibly valuable to like learn and understand the game. I like looking through it.
For sure. I like it a lot. All right. Another question I got for you here. Our buddy Dave Petrosiello that you mentioned did very, very well this past season. Mm-hmm. He says, is there something to be said for spending less draft capital on closers and OCs than in the mains? Obviously a bigger pool, but also people giving up come August. I know I won't always hit some home runs like I did with Suarez in mid rounds and Yates on the free agents, but I feel it's a great path to finishing high overall if you hit like that, or close. So I guess he's asking, do you see spending less draft capital on closers and OCs than in mains? Because you kind of mentioned taking two in OCs for the most part. Obviously, some don't, but
again at the lines. Top, again, I hope it didn't come off too much like that. At the top, you see both, right? Usually one, right? Normally, like, I tried to bucket certain things. A lot of the people near the top, though, like, there is that benefit to getting that round 18 Robert Suarez. Like, you can hit. The problem is that if you miss twice, if you try to do it, if you don't take anyone at the top and then you hit and then you try to go two, three guys at the back, but then you miss on them, it's tough to come back from that, right? In OCs, there's going to be, I think in mains too, especially OCs, you know, much lower player pool, right? Much more players on the wire. So you're going to find, especially like people checking out and stuff with OCs and stuff, like there's opportunity to get the closers you need at the end of the season, but you can't just wait till the end of the season either. Like this year, there were a couple guys that popped up, like Foley popped up, Yates popped up. Like, again, prior the year before, there was like nobody that popped up. So you could say, hey, this is going to be the year that like five guys pop up, but you don't know. So personally, like, you see both at the top of the draft. Like, it's up to your, if again, game theory says wait and hit. That's what the game theory, because someone's going to hit. Why not you? Right? Like, that's just fact. Someone's going to wait on closers. Robert D. Pool hitter, the year that he won the DC 5 years ago, like, he's talked about this on his pod. Like, he hit on late closers. Like, you know, every competition is different. The DC, you can't pick people up. But, yeah, I don't know. Like, for me, like, yes, I'm going after the overall. I play volume, but I want to hit the ground running with some guys that actually have the job. That's just a me thing. But again, somebody is going to hit, and will they have the offense and starting pitching to go with it? That's the question. But it's everyone. There's, you know, it's mindset and preference. I don't think you can say there's one way to do it. I don't think you can look all the day we looked at today, everything I've talked about today. Like, I don't think from all of it, it shows me that there isn't one way. There isn't one clear way. You know, you gotta, it's a little bit of like a feel from a draft perspective, like what works for you. What do you, how do you like to build and kind of tweak off of that?
And I think it's a phenomenal way to kind of wrap things up here. Is, you mentioned in the end, yes, we can look at all these trends and data sets and all that, but do you is the biggest thing. Like, what works for you? What works for your strategy, your mindset, and all that kind of good stuff as well. All right, I do have one more listener question here, but it's not really a strategy question so much. It's actually about a move that took place recently. Brand C at Big Bad B Wolf on Twitter, big NFC guy. Thoughts on Conforto's value with the Dodgers? I doubt they paid him $17 million to be a bench bat, but if Teoscar resigns, that's what he'll be unless they're comfortable with him in the right field, which I doubt, and that would hurt Pahez's value too. Lots of moving pieces. Yes, lots of moving pieces in LA, lots of them. I think it affects James Outman a ton. Any hopes of James Outman playing much? Because Edmund's the center fielder. That's the brass tacks of it. And so there's moving pieces around that. What are your thoughts on Conforto joining the Dodgers?
Look, I think he's their left fielder. I think as long as he's healthy, they're going to put him out there. That's just what I don't now that they signed him, you never know with the Dodgers. I don't see them
Teoscar.
I don't see them re-signing Teoscar. They got Pahez. Like, I just think that, like, you're not going to pay, again, Dodgers live in a different world, but, like, yes, you're not going to even what was it, 16, 17 million?
17 million, yeah.
He's their left fielder, right? As long as he's healthy. Also, Conforto proved, again, I've was out on Conforto last year. Not sure I'm even in on him this year. Well, now he's on the Dodgers, I'm way more interested. Yes. I actually looked at that a little bit before this pod. Like, he had a good – he showed that he still got it last year. So, obviously, the Dodgers believe in him too. So, I would be again, I don't know how much Conforto I'll have, but I think he's a left fielder. He's probably going to be hitting at the bottom – near the bottom. He's probably going to be hitting, like, 6-7, maybe 8. I don't know, but like, he's on the Dodgers, so that's a good way to get a piece of that. And again, I don't have his price right in front of me, but he's got to be relatively, like, he's definitely going to move up now that he's signed, but he's got to be relatively affordable.
In the last 16 draft champions drafts, because I don't have any other real data on here, ADP of 376. So in your OC, he's probably not even drafted.
Yeah, that's gonna move up. That's gonna move up for sure. I like Conforto. I haven't been on in the last couple of years, but Dodgers are gonna be confident, and I don't see them resigning. So I think left field's his job as long as he's healthy, right? He's got health concerns. It's kind of all I got there.
Yeah, I know they like Teoscar. I like Teoscar, but I think it's Conforto, Pahez, and Edmund. Dodgers can always Dodger, though. Like you said, they got the money to do whatever they want, so you never know. But I'm with you as well on that one.
And I think that like, they should not sign. In my opinion, they should let, they got a good crowded, like, minor league system. Like,
yep,
you got to pair those elite, all the money you invested with some talent coming up. I think that's important in, like, the game. So I hope that they do that and they don't re-sign Teoscar, because, like, these kids deserve to play,
Yeah, I have a lot of Pahez shares already, so I agree with you 100%. Let's do this. Let's see what happens in that regard. But, all right, Steven, we're going to wrap it up there. Before we head out of here, if you want to plug anything you're working on or that might be coming out, you want to promote anything, knock yourself out. Otherwise, I'm looking forward to seeing when you got these things available. But the floor is yours before we head out of here.
Yeah, so you can follow me on X. It's Steve-O Swerve. Everyone calls me Steve-O Swervy in the NFBC. But, like, I had to take the X3 because someone else stole the Steve-O Swerve tag. But, everyone calls me different things. So, like, I kind of just rolled with the O Swervy thing. But definitely follow me. I love the NFBC. It's my passion. I was destined to play this game. Like, I was. And I have so much fun, like, posting things on X, like, things I'm interested in that I think can help people. And I was out in Vegas this past March and I met Bubba and FPAS, and I'm trying to get involved. So I do have some things I'm working on. I don't have a timeline though, right? I want whatever I put out to be a really good product. And I have some idea. I don't have exact dates, but I'm working on some things. Again, everything I'm talking about today about the NFBC, like, it's all centered around their data and stuff. So I'm having fun with it. I don't have anything exactly like plug on that front, but just be on the lookout. And I'm looking forward to another great baseball season this upcoming March.
Well, I'm looking forward to it as well, the season and whatever you have cooking over there. I'm looking forward to seeing when it's fully up and running, because your stuff's really cool, getting to peek at some of it at FPAS and everything. It's and then just share what you shared on the show today. It's fun to see what you got there. So looking forward to all of that, and looking forward to chatting with you again sometime, man. So I appreciate you joining me.
Thank you, Bubba.
All right, everybody. This is Bench with Bubba, episode 704, with the one, the only, Stephen Goodwin. Catch you all next time.